It's time for the all-new Gervie's Law, cross-examining the ages, with your host, Alan Gervie, and introducing your co-host, Michelle Lobato. Alan is the managing partner of the law firm of Rowan, Gervie, and Wynn, a workers' compensation law firm which has represented injured workers for over 40 years. And now, here's your host, Alan Gervie.
Hi, I am Alan Gervie, and this is Gervie's Law, and, you know, I want to say hello to Michelle Lobato.
Hi there.
Glad to have you on board. She's kind of new with us. We've been doing this show for 12 years, and this is her first year, so it's exciting to have you here.
I'm excited to be here.
But I want to tell you something. I don't want to chit-chat with you much longer.
Oh, geez, how nice you are.
Because today's show combines two of my passions, sports and musical theater.
Amazing passions.
You know me. You don't really know me, but you know me well enough to know that I coach every sport possible, and I'm always going to musical theater, and we've got both covered today.
Yeah, you usually don't see that crossover, you know, the jock and then the musical geek together, but if you watched Glee or High School Musical, I've seen it.
You know, you have to show some respect for our guests, because I know you weren't born. I mean, when Patrick McEnroe was in the tennis world, everyone was talking about him. He's still, of course, a commentator, ESPN commentator for tennis. But when he was playing, everyone was talking about him and his brother, John, of course. And Patrick McEnroe was the former captain of the U.S. Davis Cup team. He won a doubles title in 1989 at the French Open. He's now the president of the International Tennis Hall of Fame. He's got a great podcast called Holding Court with Patrick McEnroe, and I really want to talk to him about that, but maybe later. And, you know, ESPN, everyone's watching the tournaments. There's a lot of tournaments, maybe too many. We can talk about that as well. He is part of the power couple duo with Melissa Errico, and I'm not going to introduce her yet because she's not on the line, but Patrick is. So here's a chance for us to talk to Patrick without his wife listening in, and he can say whatever he wants to say. Patrick, welcome to Gervie's Law.
Well, finally, I can get a word in edgewise. You know, because Melissa comes on, she's gonna take over. But I must say, Alan, this is very exciting for me. And hello, Michelle, because you know, I've done many shows in my years in television and sports and so on. Radio shows, TV shows, etc. And I don't think I've ever been interviewed by an actual practicing lawyer, okay? And a workman's comp lawyer, no, you know,
Patrick,
no doubt about it.
Patrick, we don't say workman's anymore. I know your wife isn't on the line. It's workers. We have to be politically correct.
Okay,
and I'm
going to
tell you, I have to tell you, you were the hook that got you on the show, because holding court with Patrick McEnroe. Court is where I live.
Yeah, well, tennis is near and dear to my heart, but so is the law, because my dad, may he rest in peace, was a practicing corporate attorney for his entire career. And, you know, there's another McEnroe brother, Mark McEnroe, who didn't play professional tennis, but he's also a practicing lawyer, as is his wife, Diane. So we've either got tennis, music, you know, my brother John married another singer, Patti Smyth from the great group Scandal. And of course, my wife is an incredible singer in her own right, doing what she does in musical theater, doing her own cabaret, doing her own concerts all over the world, and even coming to the wonderful Southern California shortly to perform out there. And I'm going to join her out there.
And we're going to talk about that. It is really exciting. And you talk about, you know, the legal stuff running through your blood. You know, your brother John, of course, was known for objecting to a lot of calls on the court. And you as well, but not as much as John. So absolutely, right. I can see where your father's, you know, his impact and effect are in your whole family. Tell me a little bit about how your father impacted you, because I know you worked really hard. It's interesting to see when you were growing up as a young tennis player, you did all the stuff you talked about, running miles, lifting weights, you would do things differently. But how did you get that motivation from your father?
Well, my dad, you know, he worked very hard, and so did my mom. And they were, you know, started out with nothing. And we were lucky enough to move to a town where they had some tennis courts when we were kids. And so the two most important things to them were education you know, being active in sports and representing our country, which both John and I were lucky enough to do, representing the U.S. in Davis Cup. John was the greatest Davis Cup player ever for this country. And as you noted in my intro, I was lucky enough to be the captain for 10 years. But, you know, I was always John's younger brother, which I still am, as a tennis player. So I had to deal with that. And I'll tell you a very quick, funny story. Maybe it's not that funny, but when I was graduating from Stanford University with a degree in political science, I decided to take the law board, the LSATs,
right,
just because I wasn't really sure, you know, if I was going to make it in pro tennis. And my mom was always very protective of me. I was the youngest. And she said, well, you're not going to be as good as your brother. You know, I'm like, well, nobody's as good as, you know, my brother, mom. He's number one in the world. You know, so there was a little going back and forth. And my dad and my brother, John, would always be like, say my mom, you know, to shut up, to stay out of it. But I decided to take the law boards. And I studied very hard. I was a diligent student. I wasn't a great student, but I studied hard. And when I got the law board scores back and I thought I was going to do really well, my mom looked at the scores and she said, son, I think professional tennis is in your future.
That's,
so there you go.
That's kind of what happened to me, because I was going to have a television career, but then, you know, I looked in the mirror and I said, well, maybe radio would be better.
Right. So it's funny. It's funny how things sort of work out. But at the end of the day, my parents both passed away about 6-7 years ago. But my mom was very happy with the decision that I ended up making to make a career in tennis. I went into broadcasting. As you said, the captain of the Davis Cup. And so I've been very lucky to do a lot of different things in tennis. I now am sitting at our tennis academy in New York City that I help run with my brother. So I'm working with kids all the time and, you know, hoping to inspire them to get the most out of their ability, whatever that is. And that's what I do on a daily basis.
And don't forget about being the president of the International Tennis Hall of Fame, because next year there's going to be, I think, an important event when nominee Roger Federer, 20 Grand Slam wins, 310 weeks as number one. Looks like that's going to bring a lot of attention to the International mm-hmm. Tennis Hall of Fame.
You are 100% right about that. And you know, I have a feeling Roger's going to get in. Something tells me he's going to.
Something tells you.
The ballot's going to be, it better be 100%.
It will be.
But we're looking forward to that, because it's going to bring, as you said, a lot of attention. And then the year after will likely be the great Serena Williams. And then you've got Rafael Nadal and Andy Murray, you know, so a lot of what I call one-namers coming into the Tennis Hall of Fame.
It's a great time to be the president of the Tennis Hall of Fame. Before we start talking to Melissa, because I know she's joined us on the line, we're excited to talk to her. Last thing I want to ask you quickly, because it's really important to me, and we're getting a little bit serious, because I know I appreciate your stories, and they are humorous, don't think they aren't, but when you started to do Holding Court with Patrick McEnroe, you focus on some of the emotional, psychological issues in youth sports. And that's near and dear to my heart, because my best friend, Dr. Stuart Gershman, has an organization called Buddy Check for Jesse. His son unfortunately committed suicide several years ago, and he took this really awful, horrible experience, and he made good out of it by promoting an initiative to help youth sports focus on mental health and mental challenges, which we sometimes forget about. And you have been focusing on it. I know you've had Dr. Jeffrey Lieberman and Dr. Jim Lohr on the show, sports psychologist and the president of the American Psychiatric Association. Tell us a little bit about your interest in helping youth and other athletes, as my good friend Dr. Stuart Gershman does every day of his life.
Well, God bless him for doing that, because Lord knows it's needed now more than ever. And I'm happy that at least we're able to discuss it now publicly. You know, I was actually doing a podcast yesterday for the International Tennis Hall of Fame. I do one for them. And I was interviewing Dr. Brian Hainline, who's at the forefront of this actual issue. So it's fitting that you bring it up, because it's at the forefront of my mind really all the time, especially dealing with these young kids here. Melissa and I have three teenage daughters, you know, knock on wood, all doing well. But, you know, I think the fact that we're able to talk, you know, when I was a kid, it was like, hey, is this kid mentally tough? You know, and then being mentally tough then was, you know, you sucked it up and you didn't talk, you know, you didn't show your fragility or show any weakness. And there's still a little bit of that in high level sports, obviously, but it's okay to talk when you're having problems, when you're having issues. You know, we know about the society we live in now with kids, you know, on the phones all day, and, you know, so much of the their life is social media as they're growing up. So that can be a cesspool of negativity at times too. So, you know, I'm happy that more people are comfortable discussing it. Because anytime we can discuss it and bring it to the forefront, I think that helps our chances of saving as many kids as we can and just people in general.
I think a lot of people appreciate that. And Holding Court with Patrick McEnroe is on SiriusXM. Please check it out. It's important stuff. And you get to hear the Stanford graduate. But I want to turn to the Yale graduate now because I was a Brown graduate. So it's Yaleys are a little bit of a competitor here, but Melissa Errico has now joined us, Patrick McEnroe's wife and probably better half, and he would say that. She's a Tony Award-nominated Broadway recording artist and actress, a singer, a writer. In fact, some of her articles in the New York Times about life of a performer should not be missed. Really great stuff. She was called at her Carnegie Hall debut in 2022 a unique force in life of the New York theater. There's no one quite like her. She's had leads in My Fair Lady, Les Mis, High Society, White Christmas, a lot of stuff that is really near and dear to my heart. And I want to tell you, Melissa, before I let you talk, because I know Patrick said that sometimes it's hard to get in a word in edgewise. It is with me. We're going to talk about the American Songbook album and the Streisand Effect, which he mentioned, which he was trumpeting for you in L.A. in a moment. But I was recently in New York, and I went to see, I saw Outsiders, Hamilton, and Juliet, and I was sitting with my kids, 11 and 12 years old. I'm sitting there thinking, I really miss the good old age of Broadway musicals, the Sondheim, the Gershwins, the Frank Lessers, Rodgers and Hart, Oscar Hammerstein, Cole Porter, all of this stuff. And now I look and see your two upcoming projects, The Streisand Effect and the American Songbook album, and I think, yes, we are exposing not only people like me who love that stuff, but also younger people to some of the good old Broadway musicals. How have you gotten involved to the extent that you're not? And I don't want to put down the musicals that I saw. My kids kind of like them. They did like them. But I would love for them to be seeing things like My Fair Lady, Les Mis, and all of the other classics. So how have you gotten so interested and been able to facilitate that in a kind of changing Broadway musical world? Melissa, are you there?
Oh, do you hear me? Do you hear me well on this microphone?
Now we can hear you. Yeah, thanks.
Okay.
And don't tell me you didn't hear me, because if you didn't hear me, I'm not repeating it.
No, amazing husband. Brilliant answer.
That's great. I think my wife would prefer that I get put on mute, but go ahead.
No. I was very, very much hearing your extremely affectionate and over-the-top introduction. Thank you.
Oh, I love that.
So, you know, I fell in love with musicals because I encountered one of the old Rodgers and Hart musicals as a young girl. And it created, a taste for jazzy, witty, old school humor. And I'm sort of a creation of many influences. The Broadway musicals that are the classic musicals, as well as the fact that I grew up in an Italian-American family where my grandmother and her sister were performers. And her sister ran with the success the most and became one of the most successful Ziegfeld girls, a real showgirl, like an authentic showgirl, you know, with the feathers and from the 20s.
Yeah.
The Ziegfeld girls were the great immigrants and the great beauties, and Florence Ziegfeld put together one of the, you know, this is before there was Netflix, before there was radio, there was the Follies in New York. And so I grew up in a house with women who did that and who had feather boas and walked around with red lipstick and tell amazing stories about George Gershwin playing piano at rehearsal. So this is part of my the glamour that I inherited and also really appreciate. I also, through the years, have bumped into and worked with amazing people like Michelle Legrand and Stephen Sondheim. I worked with Tony Bennett one night, and he told me, Melissa, always sing the good songs.
Melissa, the Barbra Streisand effect isn't just the concert. It's a reflection on inspiration. What drew you to Barbra as a muse?
Oh, well, everything. Barbra is a lot of things. Barbra is, first of all, preternaturally gifted. She's brought some of the most exquisite kinds of beauty, that of vocal, intellectual, even colored by a woman's authority. She had authority at a time that it was unique. She's also super funny. She's all the things a garden should have, big, strong roses and small, delicate things. She's absolutely everything. So I am, if you want to just use a metaphor, like let's say I'm a painter and she's the Mona Lisa, and I'm just going to spend time just, you know, enjoying the beauty and the mystery of the smile. Or if we're in the garden, just the idea that there are so many petals on each rose, so much detail. She put care into her music and was authoritative about it as well. She gives permission to people like me to think, well, what's my natural voice? And what would it be like if I were the boss of my garden? I think I grew up in the theater where you're a worker bee and you work on Broadway and you do everything to bring a director's vision to life and you work as a team member in a cast. She did all that. Don't forget, she's really groomed by the discipline of musical theater, but she left and went to LA and made her own albums right away. And that authority and exploration of music is something I'm a little late to. I've been doing it for 15 years, but she was 26. And I started making albums on Blue Note Records and Capitol Records and Warner Music, and I've had a wonderful one on Universal, recently moved to Concord. I've been making albums my whole life, but I never stopped being a working actress as well. So I didn't quite become an industry. And Streisand sort of did, but in the best possible sense. So I'm getting a look at her, both the details of her music, just the amazing songs everybody wants to hear, like The Way We Were and Evergreen and Yentl. But I knew a lot of these people. I worked with Michel Legrand intimately. I toured the world with him. I did his Broadway musical. I've made albums with him. I've worked with Stephen Sondheim and David Shire and Peter Matz. So many people who occur in her book, I know them.
It's unbelievable.
I wanted to remind you, it's kind of cool, actually. It's almost like I knew her before I knew her, because I knew the music and I had exposure to her people before I really understood how foundationally she's attached to those
Melissa,
people.
I was just going to say, tell us how that translates into the Streisand effect, which is going to be at the Carpenter Theater in L.A. We're here to welcome you to L.A., debuting November 12th and 13th. Tell us about that. So, because, you know, just listening to you, I'm excited. I want to go. People are listening. Tell us what they'll see.
I'm in LA twice this year, and I feel like I have to tell you that I'm here I'm with you November 12th and 13th at the Carpenter Center, where I will be singing a lot of her bold, gorgeous, elegant music, and maybe remind you of what made her such a star. She's kind of the ultimate aphrodisiac of of the American songbook.
A lot of people would agree with you.
Oh my God, I am with them. And then I'm back with one of the great piano players and singers, toured with Liza Minnelli for 40 years. I have a big holiday show I'm doing in California, in LA, at the Catalina Jazz Club on December 16th.
Oh, wow.
So I'm coming back in my gorgeous White Christmas from Broadway gown, which needs its own suitcase. I was going to look like a big Christmas.
That's fabulous.
Something. So anyway, so there's two shows, and they're all related. They're all part of the same river of beautiful music. I even have some Streisand, had some very unique holiday music. So I'll be in your world with, as Tony Bennett would say, with the good songs. November 12th and 13th, and again, December 16th. So I'm so happy that you love all this. And I think it's worth giving it a try.
Absolutely.
Assuming that Streisand effect is called the Streisand effect because she has such an effect on everyone intimately in their minds. And also, she was thinking globally as well. She's always interested in...
Hopefully she'll drop by to see the show.
Oh, my God. Can you imagine? I think I would die.
I'll talk to her. I know some people who know her.
I couldn't esteem her more. So think of me as an acolyte, as a painter. Who's
think
taking
of
a
me.
Look at Leonardo.
I thought you were going to break out in song when you said, think of me. Go ahead.
She is the Leonardo da Vinci of Chanteuses. So
You have also had a recent role as Zelda Fitzgerald opposite Alec Baldwin in a new play exploring her letters with F. Scott Fitzgerald. You know, when you embodied Zelda, what parts of her stayed with you? Is there a phrase, a mood, a line from the letters that you keep circling in your head?
Well, that was a very interesting experience because, you know, first of all, I've been friends with Alec Baldwin since I was very young. He's always... he's always trusted me, and we have a beautiful friendship, and I think he wanted to get back on the stage. I was very touched to be the person he asked. What are some of my favorite quotes? Well, what's interesting about it was the power of his genius, you know, Fitzgerald's genius. You have Alec Baldwin's genius right there on the stage with it. Mm-hmm. But Zelda was a frustrated ballerina, artist, and she suffered. She suffered severely, as you probably have mm-hmm. heard. So I think she's an intellectual. I do relate to that. She had big dreams at a time in American history where it was a little difficult for a woman to stand on her own two feet. She comes up in the same time as my family and those showgirls, you know, mm-hmm. looking at the United States in the 30s and but I guess one of my favorite quotes, you know, it's like it's hard for a woman to get heard. And maybe that's one of the reasons that Streisand's so attractive. She made sure she got heard. Zelda did not. So if we were even to look at these two iconic women side by side, it's staggering how different a person's life can be. But Zelda would say things like, I don't know, I don't want to live. I want to love first and live incidentally.
Wow. You know, we only have a few minutes left. Melissa, we only have a few minutes left. We have to talk about the American Songbook album coming out January 30th, 2026. I Can Dream, Can't I?
That I'm locked in the bend of your
breakout in song.
Embrace.
Beautiful.
For dreams are just like wine.
And then there's the I Didn't Know About You. These are composed by Duke Ellington in 19...
This is all music that would have been playing around the time of the Fitzgeralds, even.
Wow, yeah. That's
30s,
just beautiful.
The 40s. This is all... It harkens back to a gentler time and a kind of fragile America, really. You can't really measure the value of these things. They're immeasurably special.
It's beautiful. And that's going to...
That album comes out completely, it will be finished by January, but it's out now. Every other Friday, I release new music, and it started in September. And they call that a waterfall release, where you release music every other week. So the waterfall has begun. So if you want to catch up with the waterfall, it's already available everywhere.
And how do people get the waterfall other than going to Niagara Falls?
It's everywhere. It's on Spotify and YouTube and Apple Music.
I was looking at the list of the songs, and they were amazing. And, you know, I happen to like Both Sides Now by Joni Mitchell. I'm Canadian, so it comes naturally. What is your favorite? Because there's so many amazing songs.
The title track is called I Can Dream, Can't I? And I like that because it's asking for permission to dream. And it's a very old song from the 30s. And for me, that encapsulates the goal of the whole album, which is the permission to dream. I think a lot of us are spending too much time being overloaded.
Right.
And I think that it's an album that hopefully will lift you to, you know, it's from the 1930s. Again, it's all, do you see a little trend here?
Yes.
The root of all this music is that is pre the Second World War, an innocent time in America.
I kind of wish I wish I was your daughters, because they're being exposed to all this. They're probably old souls, you know, through the tennis and through the sports and the dedication, and also through the music. And, you know, we wish we had more time, because I wanted to talk to both of you about, you know, parenting, and a little bit about, you know, talk about letting go of perfection. That's something I'm really interested in. And what Patrick
is the best father. He is that we are. We've known each other since I was five. We are both very interested in what we do. Obviously, you're a big tennis fan, and I appreciate you recognizing my music. The two of us have both our childhood passions have become our professions. In a way, Patrick and I never grew up.
Well, you know, both of you.
We'll come on again when we come out to L.A. one time.
We'd love that. We would absolutely love it. Come into studio. We can talk about passions.
Yep.
We really appreciate it. I just want to plug both of you for the last few seconds. Melissa will be in the Streisand Effect at the Carpenter Theater November 12th and 13th. The album, The American Songbook, I Can Dream, Can't I? And then, of course, Patrick. We didn't even talk about tennis, the state of tennis, but it's an important subject. ESPN sports commentator and president of the International Tennis Hall of Fame, holding court with Patrick McEnroe on Sirius XM. Melissa, Patrick, thank you so much for being
with us today.
You're the best. Thanks for having us.
All right, that's going to do it for another show of Gervie's Law. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.
This show is pre-recorded and furnished by Rowan, Gervie, and Wynn.